February 13th. And our committee administrator has some announcements before we get to our agenda.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to explain to the committee members what happened with House Bill 2193. Passed that out with an amendment. This was the bill that had to do with landscape contractor addresses. You amended it to add landscape businesses, which put it in violation of the single title, single subject rule. So that bill's coming back to committee probably. It will get, it'll come off the consent calendar for Thursday, and that someone will need to make a motion to bring it back to committee. The provisions we are suggesting could be added to House Bill 2127, I think is the one that is the semi-independent contractor, semi-independent agency bill for the Landscape Contractors Board.
In that particular case, the relating clause was too narrow?
In that case, the relating clause was landscape contractors. The relating clause on 2127 is State Landscape Contractors Board, which we think is broader, would be able to accommodate the address notification requirements that you put into 2193. Second announcement, we have added a legislative draft related to tourism for Thursday. Third announcement, I will not be here as committee administrator for 1 week, the 27th and the 1st of March. You will have Patrick Brennan and Marjorie Taylor here as your committee administrators, one on each of those days, and I'll be working with them to make things as smooth as possible. I'm going to visit a grandson. Unlike Representative Wilson, my grandson is not in town here. My grandson is in Massachusetts.
All right. Hey.
Any questions about any of those items? The LC is relating to tourism. I don't know if you said that, but
yes.
Have you gotten a copy for the committee members?
We will have one here for them on Thursday.
Thank you. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2152.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2152 combines restricted energy electricians' licenses and endorsements into a Class B restricted energy electrician's license. It also renames the limited journeyman limited energy electrician's license to be called Class A limited energy journeyman electrician's license.
Thank you. I want to call Joe Brewer, Building Codes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator at the Building Codes Division. We have before you today House Bill 2152. The division adopts, administers, and enforces the state's statewide building code, which includes the electrical specialty code. We also enforce the licensing and certification laws. Our division provides administrative and staff support to the electrical and elevator board as well. We provide electrical code interpretations to the 130-plus jurisdictions around the state. The bill before you consolidates 8 of the 11 current categories under the restricted energy technician license, and I apologize for the condition you find this system in, but we are trying to streamline it and make it better into one Class B license. This new license category would allow the holder to do all low-voltage work except for fire protective, nurse call, and major security signaling systems, the belief being that those systems require a higher level of expertise and some additional level of training in order to qualify an individual for a Class A license. The restricted energy technician, renamed Class B license, would allow individuals to do all work except for that. And that's going to help the situation in that currently in the field, it's an administrative nightmare. It's almost an impossibility to determine exactly what a particular individual is qualified to be wiring. It's almost impossible to know when he's working outside the scope of his current certification. So the goal is to try and streamline that and make it a simpler system for both enforcement and administration. The types of work allowed under the Class A license will not be affected by this bill. It also provides a means for existing restricted energy technician license holders to train and acquire the additional level of licensing. Eight of the categories or endorsements in the restricted energy license apply to work that is similar, both in wiring methods and materials. So it's easy to understand how a technician in the field working with many of the same materials and methods might become confused themselves if exactly where their scope of work was limited and where it wasn't. So types of work that are involved are telecommunication systems, multiple function systems, telephone cable systems, fax modems, energy management systems, things of that nature. We believe that the number of endorsements in these particular categories has led to confusion and, as I said, a great deal of misunderstanding in the field. We've experienced problems in also in trying to provide continuing education for this number of different categories. We believe that consolidating them and allowing us to focus our educational efforts will be much more effective and, again, allow us to streamline the whole process in general. Mr. Chairman, my understanding is the last time this was tried, we had 32 licenses. We went to 34. So our hope is that this effort will actually result in a reduction in the number of licenses that are required or available for individuals to work in this arena. I understand there's some conceptual amendments that are circulating. I just received a copy of those at lunch today, so we're not prepared to speak to those, and I'd be happy to take any questions that the chair of the committee might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Brewer? We may want to have you later on in the program after we have several other people testify, so
thank you, Mr.
Chair. I hope you'll stick around. Thank you. Let's have Nathan Phillips and Brian Krieg from NECA.
Mr. Chair, I'm Nathan Phillips. I'm here with the National Electrical Contractors Association. I'm an electrical contractor in Eugene, and I've been the member of the Oregon Electrical and Elevator Board for 8 years, and I'm currently chairing that board. I'm here to speak in support of this bill, and really a lot of what Joe said, I would echo that we have 30-some licenses. It's very confusing. It's very difficult to have a level playing field for contractors and their employees, and this license change would simplify things greatly and would be a real improvement. The amendments that we've proposed are really primarily editorial, and there's a few changes in content, but I think that we're pretty close to agreement with the other players in the industry, and we just would like to see this bill move forward and simplify our licensing laws so that they can be more equitably enforced.
Thank you.
Chair Knope, members of the committee, on behalf of NECA, I would like to echo that the comments about this has been a very challenging process to bring down the number of licenses, but it is a very important thing to do for the industry to make things much more streamlined out there. We do have some conceptual amendments we have left with committee staff that we would like to circulate. We've worked with those on those just over the last few days. They have not had an opportunity to circulate with BCD staff before the meeting here.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Phillips and Mr. Enkley?
Krieg.
Oh, Krieg. Sorry, Brian Krieg. I forgot the N with the Krieg. Sorry about that. Thank you very much for being here. Could you tell me, is there a corresponding fee to these license categories?
Yeah, there's a licensing fee.
So with this consolidation, have you increased the fees for certain of these professionals?
No, I don't believe there's any change in fees.
Well, that is good news.
Yeah, that's a good thing, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Are you asking us to put in the amendments to be drafted?
Yes, we would like to have the amendments drafted if possible.
Okay, we will have committee staff do that.
I can do that. I have a copy of it now. Do that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rosenbaum?
Is it your intention then to take testimony on the amendments when they come back before
yeah.
us in draft form? Okay.
I think that would be easier. We'll have to do another hearing and work session anyway, likely. Steve Rose and Lee Duncan, maybe you can come up together. Appears as though you're generally with the same group.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is Steve Rose. I'm business manager of IBEW Local Union 280, headquartered in Tangent, Oregon. I represent approximately 1,150 electricians in nine counties, including Marion County, which we're currently seated. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today on this bill. I, too, would echo the statements made by both Joe and Nathan that we have a very difficult licensing structure in Oregon. Basically, anybody that came forward that had a niche market would seek to have that put in as an endorsement. So we ended up with a whole slew of folks out there, and some of the endorsements were actually as small as a doorbell. That would be an individual that would install one twisted pair cable to a transformer from the button. So obviously there was a problem. We're in support of the idea of restructuring and the A and B licensure. There are some issues that the IBEW has, particularly with what's going on with grandfathering. And I don't know if this is a proper time to address those issues or not, or if you guys are going to need another work session to look at the amendments first.
Do you have amendments beyond the ones that are already submitted, or are those the ones you're talking about?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know exactly what you've got in front of you. What I'm looking at that the IBEW isn't supportive of, you would find on page 4, line 6. That involved somebody being able to garner a Class A license from a single RET endorsement. We proposed some amendments that it would allow for that individual to receive two additional years of training in order to garner an A license. In other words, he'd get credit for his RET licensure. But the JLE license that is now becoming an A license is a four-year apprenticeship. And so the IBEW wouldn't be in support of grandfathering in somebody that was in a niche RET endorsement into an A license, regardless of which classification they had prior.
So you're looking for two more years beyond the 2 years experience that they might have?
That's correct, yeah. And the feeling there is once you hand somebody that A license, they're capable of now performing every duty that used to be covered under all of the RET endorsements. And if it's going to be a true straight across the board from what we used to call a journeyman limited energy to an A endorsement, then I think it's appropriate that those people have the same level of training as the people that we have in the past licensed as journeyman limited energy electricians.
Would the, instead of 2 years experience, would the an additional 4,000 hours of on-the-job training, is that satisfactory to you guys?
That's the language that we'd be seeking. And in addition to that, the part that I particularly, and the people I represent have a problem with is we don't believe a 40-hour class is sufficient. We think there's an additional need for a two-year apprenticeship. Give the guy credit for the 2 years as an RET and then have him do two more years in order to garner that Class A license.
It looks like that's also part of the amendments that have been submitted. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It looks like those will be addressed.
Okay, excellent.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Lee Duncan. I'm with IBEW Local 48, Portland, Oregon. I'm the business rep for the Sound and Communication Unit and have a JLE license and formerly worked in the field. As Mr. Brewer addressed, in the field currently, there is a lot of confusion with compliance in the areas that the RATs and JLEs are working and the work they should be and should not be doing, and I think this bill will really alleviate that on the compliance and enforcement issues, helping the inspectors tremendously in that respect. And along with Steve Rose, I have to agree that more training is needed, especially in the fire life safety areas. That was the areas I specialized in, and those areas in particular require extensive training to get up on the proper way to cable not only the detectors and devices, but also the programming of the panels. And people's lives depend on this every day. So, you know, to me, it's critical that they receive more than that 40 hours training. There's no way you can give somebody 40 hours and cut them loose on a fire alarm or life safety system. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these gentlemen? Thank you very much for coming down. I appreciate it. Looks like we have another panel. John Miller, Rick Thomas, and Steve, tell me your last name. Wiggy. Steve Wiggy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. I did want to echo what Mr. Brewer talked about, the need for this bill. This has been a priority of our organization to reduce the number of licenses, reduce the confusion in the field, and clear, put a fine line between those licenses. However, I know you'll see some amendments going around, proposed changes, which Rick, to my left, will talk about. But I want to first get on the record. You know, Steve Rose did talk about the additional apprenticeship and on the grandfathering. Grandfathering is very important in this bill. Here we have people in the trades that have been doing this as their business. And what we're doing is we're putting those licenses into a different category. Now, obviously, when you do that, they're going to encompass a little more than what they currently have. We've addressed that in the bill with the training and the test, obviously, and we can... Mr. Chair, we are going to be working on this probably following this hearing to work this out. But I want to state for the record, though, that requiring the 2 years apprenticeship on top of that is going to put a lot of my folks, my members, you know, here they've been in business for many years, and now they're going to be, in some cases, not be able to work alone because now they're apprentice again. And so I want to make it real clear to the committee, it's very important in the details when we work out this grandfathering issues that we're not putting business owners out of what they've been doing for the last few years or for a long time. And so this is very important for us in this issue. And I know we just got these amendments right before the hearing, but I want to state for the record, this bill is a priority of ours, but this is a very, very important issue that if we don't get resolved, will be have a serious impact on the open shop electrical community around the state in all parts of this state. And I just wanted to get that on record. Obviously, we'll have to leave this committee and work on that, but it's a serious concern to us. To my left, Mr. Chair, is Rick Thomas, the executive director of IEC. To my right, Steve Wiggy, contractor from Boring, Oregon, to talk to you about some of the details of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Thomas, Executive Director of Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. Again, I will stress that we do believe that there is a need for this bill and to consolidate the number of licenses to make it easier, not only for the businesses, but also for government and interpreting who has what and who's working to the proper scope out in the field. There are a couple of amendments that we do feel are necessary to the bill. The first is regarding the amendment on the education side, just clarifying, putting something in the bill to require that the first 2 years of the Class A's apprenticeship program be relatively similar to the 2 years of the Class B license, so that in the future any individual that would wish to upgrade from that B to that A license would reasonably be able to do so without starting over from scratch, considering that in theory there's going to be some overlap of the issues that are going to be addressing those programs. The second is amendment on the test issue for the Class B that we have had some conversations about, and I think most sides are going to agree, but on the Class B license, since most of these individuals have been in the field working on a similar scope. They are going to have 30 hours of education, but not requiring a test beyond that, since, again, they took an initial test when they got their, whatever their license and endorsements are at the current time. And then we also have some opinions on the timelines. The real reason for those is to take into consideration individuals who are currently in apprenticeship programs. If we were to, you know, for instance, on the current ones that are in a apprenticeship program for fire alarm, nurse call, and protective signaling, this would, the bill as written currently, the effective date of the bill, those individuals would have to already hold that license. Well, individuals during a two-year apprenticeship program are still in the process of finishing education up. So rather than having them start over, we'd like to, you know, see one, push those dates out a little bit to consideration. And again, I'm sure there'll be some hearings on the conceptual amendments that were presented by the earlier group of speakers. But to reiterate what Sean said, we do have some concerns that we'll address at that time, but do believe that individuals that are currently working on some of these live fire and safety issues that have the similar equivalent of the Class B license, that they'd be allowed to have some reasonable ways to move up their license without having to go all the way back through an apprenticeship program.
Chairman Knoop, members of the committee, I'm Steve Wiggy. I am a business owner. I am a member of IEC Oregon on the board of directors there, and on committee with the Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee for Limited Energy in the state of Oregon. And I agree with everyone that's spoken here so far today that we do need to get the licenses reduced down to where it makes sense to everybody, both the inspectors as well as the employers and the employees. And as a card carrier and as an owner of the business, I would like to see some way that it is done in a way that people currently doing business are not hurt by it, so that if a person has a license at this time, they can continue doing what they're doing. There's a time frame that they have to retest or to get more hours that would be allowed, so that you're not hurting some of the industry by giving them a deadline and saying if you don't have it within 2 months, when it takes 2 years to do it, that they could no longer do business. So those are my main concerns there on this. And again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for this particular panel? Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wiggy, what does limited energy mean?
Okay, your
limited energy journeyman electrician.
Okay, limited energy journeyman electrician would low voltage, less than like 100 volts. There's other criteria due to amp voltage, you know, the wattage that is used. So, I mean, it gets more technical. It's not your current high voltage electrician that the line voltage electricians are licensed to. It's all the specialty trades for the lower voltage, ones that may not kill you if you touch them.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Follow up?
So mainly residential type, electricity?
No, no.
Versus
no.
The high line wire?
No, it would be telephone, voice and
yes.
data,
yes.
Cable TV, things that do not carry high amperages.
Great,
thank
you.
Any other questions, committee?
Just one. Mr. Chair.
Representative Zana.
For Sean, does it look like you guys are going to get together and work it out yourself and have something firm for us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zana, I think that would probably be the best thing to do, since we've all just finally come together on what we all want is to go out and meet with building codes. Obviously, look at the original intent of the bill, which was to make it easy, consolidate the license, but make it easy on the business community and everybody to get into those areas. I think that was the intent, and we want to just work with all parties and come up with a solution to come back to the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for anybody that wants to respond to it. Did you participate in a process that resulted in the original bill? Any of you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, yeah, we did correspond with the building codes this interim. Actually, Gary Wilson, who's the chief electrical inspector, who works with many of our contractors and the other contractors, is the chief architect of the bill. He's highly respected, I will say, on not just NECA and IBW, but us as well. And he was the chief architect of the bill, and we all had input in the interim on the product, which were generally supportive with the minor changes. But yes, to answer your question.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you. We do have about, looks like, two more witnesses for this particular bill, but I'm going to recess this hearing because we have another bill that we're going to go to. And if anybody has to leave, already testified on this first bill, we will understand. It is my intent to request that the groups go out with DCBS, and I'm going to ask my capable vice chairs, Rosenbaum and Zahner, to oversee potential meeting there and maybe direct it a little bit. If for some reason you need to come back to the chair and can't agree, there's a possibility of pain involved for everyone. So let's see if we can't work this out. And with that, I'm going to recess the hearing on House Bill 2152, and we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2696. And Mr. Stembridge, do you have some information?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2696 would add members to the Commission for Child Care. Currently, 10 members would add 2 members. One would be a for-profit representative of business to be appointed by the President of the Senate. One would be a not-for-profit representative of business to be appointed by the Speaker.
Thank you. I'm going to have a panel come up, and that would be Mark Overbeck, Rob Patridge, Representative Rob Patridge, and Representative Kafoury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I guess I'll go first. Deborah Kafoury, State Representative, House District 18, and I am currently a member of the Commission for Child Care. As you are all well aware, child care is an issue of great importance to businesses, both large and small. The National Study of Changing Workforce found that companies with supportive work-life policies, including assistance with child care, were more likely to have higher job satisfaction levels, more commitment to their company's success, greater loyalty to their company, and a stronger intention to remain with their company. For large businesses in Oregon, such as Intel, providing employees with assistance in meeting their child care needs has been a central part of their strategy to recruit and retain high-quality workers. For small businesses, the cost of continually having to hire and train new employees can dramatically impact their bottom line. This bill would provide an avenue for the business community to be represented in the efforts to enable all families to have access to safe, quality, and affordable child care. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rob Patridge, State Representative, House District 50. I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2696. I'm pleased to be here today as a member of the Oregon Child Care Commission for the past 2 years. I think the commission is making some great strides under the leadership of our current membership, as well as Mark Overbeck, who has come on board during the interim as the commission administrator, and has done a phenomenal job. Part of what was lacking in this particular commission is representatives from the business community. This would allow for 2 representatives from the for-profit business community, as well as 1 representative from the not-for-profit business community. And being a corporate counsel for a not-for-profit business, I think it is critically important, since our company as a not-for-profit employs over 1,200 employees. Child care is a substantial issue that we all must face and deal with. It plays a substantial role in making sure we in state government later on aren't putting the bills for what's caused early on and the lack of good quality, safe child care early on. The commission has promulgated and put forth lots of suggestions and made some great headway and strides during the last legislative session. Has a fairly aggressive agenda for this session that is supported both in the co-chairs and the governor's budget this time. So we're excited about the possibility and believe that these two additional members will add some more insight and information to the commission and add a different perspective.
Good afternoon, Chair Knope and committee members. My name is Mark Overbeck, and I am the interim executive officer for the Oregon Commission for Child Care. The Commission for Child Care is the advisory body to the governor and to the legislature on child care issues in Oregon. Our members include, in addition to three legislators, two of whom are here before you, representatives from the child care profession, consumers of child care, business and labor, the medical, tax, and legal professions, and state and local government. Of the 15 slots on the commission, only one is dedicated for a representative of business. I want to thank you and the committee for your timely hearing of this bill. Just yesterday, Mr. Chair, as you know, the commission released its 2001 report to the governor and legislature, which included specifically a recommendation that two business members be added to the commission as we try to strengthen the connection with employers in the arena of child care. Oregon's businesses do recognize that child care is a workplace issue that impacts their bottom line. More Oregon employers are investing in quality child care for their workers than ever before as a strategy to recruit and retain a quality workforce, just as Representative Kafoury said. In 1993, when the legislature saw fit to take the child care regulatory function and the Commission for Child Care Resources and move them under the auspices of the Employment Department, I think they recognized that. During the past several years, I just want to note that the Employment Department has been an excellent supporter of our efforts to have safe, quality, and affordable child care available for all Oregon families. By adding two members representing business to the commission, I believe that the legislature will acknowledge the vital role that businesses play in the development of solutions. And lastly, we have promised that as this bill moves forward through the process and as it is hopefully implemented, these new members will not impact government's bottom line. There will be no fiscal impact to this bill's passage. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for our panel? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kafoury, Representative Patridge, and is it the Director Overbeck? Can you explain to me how are these commission members paid?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the members of the commission are not compensated other than as the budget allows. They are compensated per state statute, that is the non-legislative members are, for travel and per diem expenses.
And what would that be, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the commission has had for the last several years a set number of hearings. We're not allowed to meet for business purposes more than 10 times in any calendar year, and we cannot meet more than once every 30 days. If this bill is passed, we will restructure so as to make good on our promise not to have this impact the commission's bottom line.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
Hey, what do you pay?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, we pay for travel, the going rate, it has been, I believe, 32.5 cents, and I believe it's going to 34.5 cents, state travel policy. And the per diem expenses are $7.50 for breakfast, $7.50 for lunch, and $15 for dinner.
So $30 a day. So an average annual income based on commission work is what?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I apologize. I don't have those specific figures my hand. We have an average of 10 of our 15 commissioners who attend each meeting, and again, we have 10 meetings per year.
Just for the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office issued a minimal expenditure impact statement, and minimal does mean minimal. Yeah. Any other questions?
Which means what, Mr. Chair?
Minimal.
As in less than 100,000 or?
Less than 50,000.
Less than 50,000.
Yes, it'll be far less than that.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
For the record, State Representative Rob Patridge, maybe to get at Representative Nelson's question, it's if we calculate it out at $30 a day, it's and we have 10 meetings a year, that's $300 a year. So to add two members, it's about $600 a year or $1,200 a biennium, and we don't know where these particular members happen to be from. So it's $1,200 plus. If they happen to be from Eastern Oregon, it's going to cost us more because they're going to have to travel that distance. So we can't give you anything more than probably the $1,200. If they live here in Salem, you know, or depending on where the commission meets, it's going to vary. So, I mean,
certainly it wouldn't be over 5,000. So, I mean, we're talking.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson.
I just wondered who kept the books for your organization. So is that your job, Mr. Overbeck? For your commission, I mean, who handles this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I apologize, I didn't understand the question. Could you repeat the question?
When a commission has travel and per diem, who, a commission, not legislators, who handles your the fiscal part of your commission?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I'm accountable for the expenses of the commission. Those are handled through the Business Services Division of the Employment Department.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
So, Mr. Obey, what is the total budget for this commission now?
Mr. Chairman,
the final.
Representative Nelson, our budget approximates $157,000 per biennium total currently.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. And since we only have one other witness, we'll try to finish this one off. John Reeves.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Reeves. I'm the Program Director for Child Care Information Service, which is one of the resource and referral programs that serves Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. We work with local businesses to educate them on the importance of quality and affordable child care for their employees' children. It's vital that businesses are included in finding ways to focus on family needs to help retain employees, give them incentives and benefits, and find new ways to reduce child care costs. Employees with a consistent, without consistent child care arrangements are not productive, tend to change jobs more often and or lose their jobs, which is an issue that we deal with fairly often, parents contacting us, attempting to locate child care more often than they should need to, whether they're educated formally on what to look for or issues like that might come into play. So educating the employers is a very important piece of this, which helps parents so they're not struggling for this search, and they can also help them deal with some of the issues of putting their kids in child care and that kind of thing. So having the business perspective on the Commission for Child Care is an important step in convincing all employers to value the children and the families that are concerned in these issues, and we would hope that you would support House Bill 2696 to add the two business members to the Commission for Child Care.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Reeves? Oh, Representative Nelson.
This is close to my heart.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeves, what have you done in Yamhill County regarding this? I'm curious.
Mr. Chair,
what has been your specific role? I mean, what have you accomplished in Yamhill County in child care?
As far as with employers or with
anywhere
with child care?
Well, anyway,
what we do is we give referrals to parents, and we have a significant number of child care providers in that community that we help parents locate and give them information on selecting quality care.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
A referral through, help me with that.
We're a child care resource and referral agency, and what we do is help them. They give us information on what they're looking for in child care, and we help them, you know, understand what questions to ask, what to look for in a quality child care program, and we give them referrals to child care programs that are located in that community. So it could be center-based child care or family child care programs, and there's just probably a little over 170 child care providers on our database in the Yamhill County area.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
What would be the center program you were talking about in Yamhill County?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, there are a few center-based programs. Those are the, you know, formal child care programs based outside of the home in the business community. So there are, like I said, there's a few of them on our database.
What would they, excuse me, follow-up, please. Could I know the name of them?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I don't have enough information at this point. I could get you a list from our database of the child care centers that are on that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Reeves.
Thank you very much for your time.
We're going to, anyone else wishing to testify on 2696? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing, and we are going to go to work session on this in just a little bit. But we have Representative Close in the room, who I believe is with a constituent, and I want to make sure that we send Representative Close back to Ways and Means as soon as possible. So we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2481 for the purposes of allowing Representative Post to give testimony. And so please come forward and bring your constituent with you if you would like.
Thank you, Chair Knope, and members of the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee for hearing House Bill 2481. I'm State Representative Betsy Close from House District 36. House Bill 2481 was requested by my local Albany Consumer Credit Counseling Agency, and Jan Amling is here on their behalf. It's a request for a fee increase from $25 to $50 for initial setup of the client's account. Those of you who know me know I'm not an advocate of raising fees. In this case, I consider it a reasonable request for a vital service. Consumer Credit Counseling performs a wonderful service for our communities, that of assisting people in financial difficulty to arrange for payment of their debts. When I was a high school teacher, I invited them to speak to my classes regularly on personal finance. Consumer Credit Counseling educates our communities about budgeting and control of debt. Their funding difficulties, which they will tell you about more, arise in situations where people come for an initial consultation but do not sign up for the program. Consumer Credit Counseling needs to be able to recover the cost of counseling and educating those persons who come on a one-time only basis. I ask you to consider carefully their request for additional funding. Thank you for your time. Well spent.
Thank you. Jan Amling.
Thank you. I am Jan Amling. I am the executive director of the local Consumer Credit Counseling Service in Albany, Oregon. The Consumer Credit Counseling Service agencies in the United States are members of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, and our is to help people understand their finances and to perhaps restructure things so that they're able to have more satisfaction with what their money is doing for them and the extent of their indebtedness. Because we are members of the National Foundation, the NFCC, all of the CCCS agencies have annual audits. We have boards of directors. We have certified counselors. And we are accredited by the Council on Accreditation for Children and Family Services, which is a rather onerous process if you're aware of accreditation. In Oregon, there are 10 CCCS agencies. We have lots of competition from for-profits and not-for-profits from around the United States. 70% of our income is from contributions to the creditors that we send funds for families that need prorating service. The 24% of our funding comes from the clients themselves that sign up for a debt management program, and the other 6% is from HUD grants, United Way, or other types of small amounts of money. There's been an erosion in the contributions that we've been receiving from the credit grantors for several reasons. The probably the largest source of place where we send our money is back to charge cards and credit cards. Those companies have across the board reduced the contribution that they have given to the people that are doing this prorating, partly because of the large amounts of credit that they have extended and the amount of that debt that is bad, and because of a lot of the competition that we have experienced from outside of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. So these companies are being swamped with requests for funding agencies such as ours, so they've reduced the fair share contribution that any of us get. So in Oregon last year, across the agencies, we have experienced 11% reduction in our funding, and so we're trying to find other ways to fund our service. That funding that we've gotten, that 70% of our funding, has basically paid for all of the counseling that we do, whether it's the regular financial counseling or HUD counseling for pre-purchase, foreclosure, rent delinquency, the education that we do to welfare groups, to the high schools, and to people that do not pay us for education, and it pays for the prorating service. So obviously all the funding is coming, where the primary point of the funding is coming from the prorating service, but it's having to pay for everything. 31% of the people that we counsel are actually going to go on to a debt management program, so 69% of the people that we see are not going to ever give us a dime for the help that we've given them. So we are asking for basically two things in this bill. One is to be able to charge a counseling fee. That is not specified in the bill what it would be, but the Department of Business and Consumer Services could be in charge of determining what that amount would be. We're proposing a $50 cap on that. The other thing that we're looking at doing is to increase the setup fee from $25 to $50. We would not charge both fees to a family. We would only charge one. And both of those fees are a sliding scale. We can waive those fees also. So the bill is looking at two things. One is to allow us to charge for counseling, and the second thing is to increase the setup fee, but we would charge only one or the other. We often see people that have an issue with, if I go on your prorating services, is going to affect my credit. And any time that a payment is cut to a creditor that is less than what the statement is asking for has the potential for hurting their credit. So there are people that we need to counsel, we need to take a certain amount of time with to explain to them the Federal Trade Commission regulations that changed in this past year having to do with re-aging. We need to talk to them if they think that they want to do settlements for their creditors. We have to explain the downside, how that could impact their credit. So these counseling sessions could take a fairly lengthy period of time. And so it seems logical to request those people pay for our time to help them get through this process if they're not going to be using our prorating service. We do have at least one agency in the state that is in very dire straits and is close to closing their doors because of the reduction in their income. And they have requested that we ask this to have an emergency clause to make this bill, if it's passed, to be enacted as soon as possible. They might be able to find some temporary sources of funds to keep them open if they knew that this change would happen for them. So that's a rather sketchy approach to what consumer credit counseling does and the need for the fees. But I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Backman.
Thank you. Could you give us some idea about how many people they're counseling?
Right. In the testimony that I prepared that I did not read, I was encouraged not to read what I'd written because you can read. The information that we gathered for the families of the 10 CCCS agencies in 1999, we counseled 19,137 families. We established 5,868 debt repayment plans returned over $36 million to the credit community. In 1999, we did 188 educational programs in schools, reaching over 3,500 students, and we made 564 community presentations, reaching an audience of over 20,000. So that was the figures that we'd gathered for 1999.
So you've been very busy.
We are extremely busy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. My question would be, in light of what appears to be our economy of late, is it more likely or less likely that business will be picking up?
We are absolutely swamped. The last 2 months have been incredible. We always experience an influx of people in January, and that could be because in December they're out spending the money and don't want to be accountable for things, and come January the bills start coming in, but we've been really swamped. I spoke to a person from a credit union over the weekend, and she said that they are extremely busy too. She works for the HP Credit Union and asked if I would come do counseling in person at HP on site again, start doing that. So I think that the credit granting community is seeing a lot of people. There could be various explanations, and if you have business people on the panel, perhaps you have some thoughts too. But with the increases in the mortgage rates that had been experienced, fewer people were getting the bailouts by getting additional mortgages on their homes. And so that door was closed to them. That was something that they had been doing to alleviate their situations over the past couple of years. So that could be putting a little pressure on why we're seeing more people too. Another thing is the bankruptcy legislation that the federal government has proposed goes into effect. If it goes through as proposed, the bankrupts would have two occasions that they would be forced to see somebody such as our agency. One, before they could file the papers for bankruptcy, they would need to have a consultation so that the people could understand what other options they had besides filing bankruptcy. The second option would be before the bankruptcy could be discharged, they would have to undergo educational classes so that they would not go bankrupt again. So if the federal legislation goes through as proposed, and of course at this point it is suggested that the Bush administration would be sympathetic to that legislation, there will be a tremendous demand for our services in the future.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Umling, I'm glad you mentioned the bankruptcy legislation because that's it, right, the nail right on the head. And of course the Bush administration is favorable to that because credit card companies get a pretty good deal on that bankruptcy legislation. That's why it was delayed in implementing. I have two questions for you. One is, how much do the credit card companies contribute to this fund that gives you part of your operating money?
That has varied over time. I've been with Consumer Credit Counseling Service since 1979. Originally, bank card companies would give us a contribution that would amount to about 10% of what we sent them. That went up to 15%, and now it's down to 6 and 7%. So it's less than where it started out 20 years ago.
Okay, that's a bad situation in my opinion. Credit cards are frequently out there in the mail, and that's how come a lot of people get in trouble. Second question I have is, are you regulated by DCBS?
Yes, we are.
Okay, and it's in the statutes, and they govern you, and that's why you can only charge $25.
Right. The way ORS 697.692, it says that we may charge a setup. We cannot charge for any conversation that does or does not result in a debt management program.
Okay.
We can charge up to $25 for setting up a debt management program for those clients going on our program, and we can charge a monthly fee of up to 15% of the funds that they give us, but most of the agencies cap that at $35. So what we're trying to do is get the people that are not using the debt management service to pay for the counseling.
My third and final question, if I might.
Follow up.
Has your national organization, because of the bankruptcy legislation, have they been lobbying to require credit card companies to put more into this fund, particularly since the credit card companies are the ones pushing the legislation?
I don't believe that they can lobby as they are established, but they do have connections with, because of the executive committee and the advisory board at the national level has a fair amount of creditors on it, and they know what is happening and what they're looking at their numbers. The National Foundation is very proactive for the agencies and tries to collect enough data to represent to the credit grantors the need for our services. There is a very mixed feeling among those credit grantors how they perceive what we do. Bank One, for instance, at one point tried to do the same thing that we do and wanted to counsel families on how to get their money back to all creditors. They abandoned that. They decided that wasn't what they needed to be doing. They love us and they hate us. We get money back to them, but we don't favor them over somebody else. Mm-hmm. And if they were doing the collecting, they would favor themselves.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much for your answers.
Representative Merkley. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have standard contracts with these different creditors in terms of you collect so much money for them and they pay you a certain percent back?
There's a letter of understanding that the National has with many of these creditors that they would contribute a certain amount. That has gotten to be a rather murky situation. A couple of the large creditors, such as MBNA, are performing their own due diligence with the agencies and want to make sure that we do not, MBNA, for instance, will not give us a contribution if the primary creditor that the family owes is MBNA. They want to see that there's a mix of creditors in the same pool. First USA has their criteria for what they will give a sliding scale fair share to us, depending upon how valuable they perceive our services. So for some of them, it's a flat amount, and for others, it varies upon how helpful they see our agencies, very individually. Very expensive for them to create their own matrix and decide and give us the contribution.
Follow up. So when a low-income client or someone, I guess not necessarily low-income, but somebody in debt trouble comes to you, and they have debts with different types of creditors, some of those creditors pay you a higher percent than others. And how do you resolve the inherent conflict of interest that this creates over how you structure the return of debt?
Pretty easy. The National Foundation has mandated that we will not give any preferences. We have, in the beginning, when I first started, a creditor would ask for a payment that was 5% of the balance. Over time, that has gone down to 4, 3, 2, 1.9% of the balance is all they want.
Monthly payment you're speaking of?
Right. So if you owe Sears $1,000, they used to want a payment that was 50. Now they may ask for one that's 19. And the service, the finance charge could be $15 of that. So only $4 a month would go to the balance, to the principal. I personally try to send a payment that is 3% of the balance because half of that is going to be interest. But some of the creditors will say, we'll take 2% or we'll take 1.9. And at that point, the counselor has to decide whether or not it's in the family's best interest to get on some kind of a repayment arrangement and send that smaller fee when a very small amount of it is going to go to the principal, or whether they should structure all of them to get 3% or 2.5. But there are some guidelines that we work within.
Well,
if I explain much more to you, I might hire you as a counselor.
Thank you. The
it's Merkley. You said Merkley. Although Merkley, that's it.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
But you're negotiating a reduction in the principal owed as part of this or not?
We're negotiating a repayment, but not the balance.
So you're not striking a deal that will help this family who's not currently making payments to you will make payments, but you need to cut the principal in half, anything of that nature?
No. No, it's only the payments and hopefully the interest rate the family's going to pay.
Okay. Why is that?
Why don't we go for a negotiated settlement?
A negotiation of the amount owed?
I think a Chapter 13 is probably the only route that I know that where you can do that. We do not have the force of law behind us. We cannot make the creditors accept a smaller amount. The downside to a settlement is that the creditor can report to the IRS the balance that is not paid as income, and the family would have to pay income taxes on it. The second downside to that is that the person could still have showing on their credit report the balance that had been forgiven as a balance that was still outstanding. So if the person went to get more credit, they would perhaps be denied because they still had balances showing on their credit record. So we are trying to get the creditor to take accept a smaller payment and perhaps to reduce the interest rate and to re-age the account so that there won't be late charges. So there are specific things that we're trying to get the creditor to do, but we never do go after getting the balance reduced.
Okay. You know, in your one more follow-up. You know, in your testimony, that you'd like to have the option of $50 setup fee or $50 counseling fee. Do you have any objection for us to putting that $50 fee actually into the language of the bill, whereas currently
the fee
is not set?
I do not. I would prefer if the business, the Department of Kruger's, I always want to get you more twisted around. If they could establish that, because if it went into law, I could be up here in 5 years asking you to change it again, especially if we're doing bankruptcy counseling where perhaps we need a larger amount. I'm comfortable with Mr. Kruger's agency setting the limits on that, as he does for the educational fees that we can charge. He sets a range that we can charge for those.
Representative Nelson, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a sad business to be in, and how wonderful that it could end up changing somebody's life and restoring happiness to a home. And it must be very frustrating at many times. Is this a for-profit business?
No, we have a 501c3 standing with the IRS. We are a not-for-profit. Our intention is not to earn a profit for ourselves.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me speak. I appreciate it.
We have Jim Kruger left from DCBS, Division of Finance and Corporate Security. That's what that abbreviation is.
Probably my writing also.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Kruger. I'm the program manager for non-depository programs within the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Non-depository programs include the debt collection agency program that we administer. I'm going to be very brief because the subject has really been covered in great detail by the two previous witnesses. There's not a great deal that I can contribute. I'm here to tell you that we support this measure. We think it's a reasonable approach to take. The $25 setup fee was set in 1983. It has not been changed since then, despite inflation and rising costs. We think that the $50 fee as an alternative to a setup fee for those people who do not go through the services that the consolidators ask for is a reasonable fee also. We have a total of 18 licensed locations conducting this activity, 10 of which are CCC-affiliated. 8 are not affiliated with that organization, but 3 or 4 used to be and were taken over by a Salem not-for-profit organization. I want to address the option of setting the fee in the rule or in the law, and to point out that currently the law gives the director the authority to approve fees for education classes, which we do when we receive a written request and review the materials. And our preference would be to do it by rule, but we don't object to having it in the statute. It seems a little rigid in the statute, and it doesn't provide for much flexibility, but whatever the committee prefers. I think that's all the comments I have, unless you have any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Kruger.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Just on the point of the fees for these education classes, is that set by rule at a set amount right now, or do you approve those on a case-by-case basis?
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chair, Representative, it is set at a maximum amount up to, and I believe it's $50 present time. But they provide varying types of education, and some of the classes involve more materials and more expense for producing the educational materials. So we take a look at that also. Our testimony at the time we were given that authority was that we were going to work to ensure that this does not become a profit center for these agencies, and we'll do the same thing with the fee that they're asking for this time around.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
When a deal is worked out with the creditors on behalf of a client, is interest normally frozen or modified from the terms of the initial responsibility the client would have?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that question probably should be answered by Jan, because she's more familiar with that. But it's my understanding that reduction in the amount of interest paid is a very important component in getting these people's debts paid off, and a lot of emphasis is put on that.
Any other questions from the committee for Mr. Kruger? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2481? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2481. We already need one amendment, which would be the emergency clause, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And at the direction of the committee, what's the committee's wishes with regards to the fee? Representative Merkley.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to propose that we put the fee in writing for credit counseling so that it would read similar to the initial setup fee, a fee for credit counseling of not more than $50. I can comment on that further. I can just lay that concept on the table for the moment.
Don't you lay it on the table. Anyone else? Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I would support that proposal as well. I think it's consistent with the testimony that we've received and the fee structures that exist for the other services now.
Anyone else?
Yeah.
What's that, Representative West?
I'm trying to spit it out. If I recall the testimony, when you asked about the fee, Representative Berkeley, it's easier not to have it in the statute, because then each time they want to change the fee, they have to come back before the legislature, and it's done by administrative rule. Why would you want to put it in the statute?
I'll yield to whether the chair wants to have this discussion at this moment.
Representative Merkley, that's fine. We can discuss it now as opposed to later.
Okay. Well, this goes back to my experience when I was director of Habitat for Humanity, and we had families that were seeking to purchase homes, and our agreement was they had to liquidate their debts before they could purchase a home. So they may have worked on paying down their debts, but they weren't there. And then many of them had gone through the process at various points of going through this type of credit counseling. But what they had discovered was that the process in general didn't reduce their debt. Their general understanding was, this group is going to negotiate on my behalf to reduce my debt so that the companies I owe get something, but my debt will be less. But they generally found that that didn't happen. And in fact, what happened was that their forecast for having a debt created a longer horizon, because the amount per month they were paying off on the principal became less. So then it became my responsibility to call up the creditors directly and negotiate for them to reduce their debt in exchange for payment. And I think there was a lot of sense among the low-income families I dealt with that they didn't normally understand that the credit counseling service wasn't negotiating on their behalf for this sort of debt reduction. And I feel that it's many of the families who go in, I mean, the reason they're going is they don't have the money. And $50, they may not be sure if they have $50. And so if they're in a situation where they're going in and they need counseling, and the classes are going to take something, and
the counseling may be additional fee, and then they're being 15% of what they pay in is going to be charged to a fee to the counseling agency. It just amounts to the fact that in essence, not only are the debts going to be paid off over a longer period of time, but they're paying a significant fee over time, the 15% of what they're paying to the agency. I just think that the what this amounts to is that the basic fee should not rise to such a level that families in great need of this service are reluctant to walk in the doors. And I think if the fee is going to go over $50, it ought to be a discussion of the legislature. And that's why I would be inclined to have it in the bill rather than done by regulation.
Did you have any comment after that, or was that just an acknowledgement of
Well, I wrote in my notes, Representative Merkley gave a long explanation.
I was impressed with it myself.
I appreciate the explanation. I understand what you're going for. I don't really have a problem with it. I'm just concerned, you know, we're going to see a lot of people going into bankruptcy over the next couple of years as our economy takes its downward spiral. And I'm just not sure these fees are going to be enough to cover their operations should they get so many people coming in through the doors.
I think what I'm going to do, committee, is I'm going to have the emergency clause and the fee drafted as separate amendments, and we're just going to let it. The emergency clause, I would hope that we'd all agree, should be in this bill, but as regards to the fee and studying the fee in statute, I'm going to let the committee let that rise or fall based on our work session, so whenever we can get those. And that you were referring specifically, is it to line 30, Representative Merkley?
Yes, it is.
And capping that at 50?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
You know, I must not understand this in its entirety, because, I mean, there are groups that do negotiate for a credit card, balance to be paid off. I mean, as low as much as, you know, pay only 10% and we're going to forgive 90%. I would like to, yes, there are. I'd like to have this agency one more time explain to me why we're not doing that. I mean, the burden of this tremendous debt when, you know, these credit card companies are anxious to, you know, have cash in the house and cash is king and let's move cash, you know, is more important. I'm just concerned with the regulations that prevent us from doing that, you know, a nonprofit organization on behalf of its clients.
Okay, I'll tell you what we'll do. Mr. Kruger, if you could give Representative Nelson your card, you could follow up with her, and then when we bring this bill back, if there's any further testimony that needs to be given, they can do that either at work session or through a public hearing at that time. We have closed the public hearing, I believe, on House Bill 2481, and I think we have a hearing in recess. This was our first one. And are any of those witnesses still here?
2692.
It would have been 2152.
Oh, we're jumping all over the place.
Yeah, we're getting excited. Is Madeline Elder and John Endicott still here? You are? Let's reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2152 to give Madeline Elder, who's been very patient with us. We apologize for the delay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Madeline Elder, and I am President of Communications Workers of America, Local 7901 in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Council of Communication Workers of America. And I'll be very brief. Quite frankly, we weren't part of any of the process on this bill, nor on Bill 2151, which is not coming before you. We are trying to get into the process, and we would I actually was going to testify to say that we want to be part of the process, but when we recessed, I went out in the hall. And I believe we are part of the process now. However, we do represent over 4,000 telecommunications workers, many of whom do have the RET, many of whom do have the JLE. I have the JLE myself, and as deregulation happens and so on, we are going to be required to have more licensing in the future, and we'd like to be a part of the process of making the laws that affect the jobs of our over 4,000 members. So I think that's just about what I had to say.
Well, thank you. If you need the chair to direct that the sandbox is big enough for one more person, the Communications Workers of America should be at the table, and they promise not to throw sand. So I think that'll be fine.
Mr. Chair, it shall be so, as you say.
It shall be so. That's right. And Representative Rosenbaum will be there to make sure it's so.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members.
You're welcome. Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2152? We did have John Endicott from Local 290. He probably gave up on me and went home with the rest of the group, and I apologize to him for that. And seeing no one else who wishes to testify on that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2152. And we're going to go to Senate Bill, a very important Senate Bill, 186. The reason that it's important is not because Mr. Martinez is here, because it happens to be Lynn Hannon's bill. And for those of you not in the know, Representative Hannon is the co-chair of Ways and Means on the Senate side. Senator Hannon, excuse me. We decided that we would move his fine piece of legislation to the front of the line so it could be heard. So with that, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 186, Tim Martinez. Here's to be the only one on the list.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question before Mr. Martinez is coming up?
How about we'll have Mr. Stenbridge give us a brief overview, then we'll take Representative Walker's question.
Mr. Chairman, there was a 1999 bill that set forth procedures for opening the safe deposit boxes of deceased persons. This bill includes national banks and trust companies within that law.
Thank you. Representative Walker.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering what we were doing 2696 today. Are we going to go into work session?
We're going to go to work session. Okay. That'll probably be our finale.
Okay. We're just skipping around a lot today, and I'm just having trouble keeping up. So I am just wanting to be on the same track.
Well, thank you for the question. Mr. Martinez from the Oregon Bankers Association. You almost got a promotion there, sir.
My name is Tim Martinez. I'm not a representative, nor am I Senator Lynn Hannon. But I appreciate you hearing this bill today. Frankly, I don't have egg on my tie. I have egg on my face. In 1999, Senate Bill 839 passed this body. Everybody in this room that was in the legislature in 1999 voted for it. It was at our request, and it was to give guidance as to what banks, savings and loans, and credit unions do when the last owner of a safety deposit box dies. Because if you think about it, we had folks coming in that wanted access to the box, and it was unclear in Oregon statutes who actually should be able to open the box. When we drafted the bill, we inadvertently left out national banks. This puts them into the law so that they are covered by these rules and regulations as well. It's a very, very simple bill, and again, appreciate you hearing it today. And I've also attached to my testimony the summary of what the bill did in the 1999 session.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martinez, isn't this the one that we had a lot of discussion about in our Judiciary Committee last session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, that's correct.
And out of all that discussion, you forgot the national bank.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, that's correct.
You certainly wear that egg well. that's fine, no problem with it. I'm just surprised that you left them out, but... Thank you.
Undoubtedly, it's a draft in here at LC. At least that's what we always say.
Yeah,
it
must have been LC.
Mr. Chairman, I would never
say that. Neither would I, considering that they're working on a lot of my bills.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Martin.
I'd like to point out that perhaps the members of the committee might share some of that responsibility from
Ooh. Ooh. I don't wear egg very well, Representative Markley. I'll try.
Any questions for Mr. Martinez? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 186, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 186.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
I would move Senate Bill 186 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wilson moves Senate Bill 186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions or discussion? If not, clerk, call the roll.
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Walker.
Aye.
Wilson.
Aye.
Zellmer.
Aye.
Backlund.
Aye.
Leonard.
Representative Leonard apparently is excused.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 186 is declared passed. And before I take a work session, do I hear another motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move that Representative Leonard carry this bill.
Good, thank you. I was thinking of another motion.
I know you were, but, you know, he's had so much fun. I think that it's about time we turn the table.
I'm going to have to agree with you on that. Representative Wilson, were you going to second that motion? Is that what you
Yes, I certainly will.
Thank you.
We are going to make Representative Leonard the carrier of Senate Bill 186, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 186. Now,
we can carry them all if we can. You have 23 that you have not worked. Only one.
Okay.
The work session that you may want to do on.
We'll get to that.
He didn't get a chance to vote yet. He may want to open it up to vote.
Representative Leonard.
It's only fair.
I was watching on TV till the vote was over.
Did you see the whole thing?
Every little thing. We'll read that.
Would you like to?
You are coming. You are carrying. Oh, 156.
86. You. Would you like to vote on that?
We would. We'd be willing to reopen the work session we just closed in order for you to vote on the vote you're carrying.
To open the box of the deceased person. Okay. Well. Okay.
We will reopen the work session on the Senate Bill 186.
Are we all good with this?
Representative Leonard?
Okay. I'm vote aye, enthusiastically.
Representative Leonard votes aye. Close the work session on Senate Bill 186. Congratulations
Thank
on
you,
carrying
sir.
That bill.
Thank you.
I'll help you.
Thank you.
I'm sure you will.
we have one more bill in a work session. Another few bills. We're going to open public hearing on House Bill 2245. And Mr.
Chairman. Yes, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2245 changes the permit fee basis for boiler permits from the area of the vessel's heating surface to the horsepower and to volume for other pressure vessels. That reduces the boiler size classifications for fee assessment from 6 to 5. And, Mr. Chairman, we do have a fiscal office report on this. There's no expenditure impact.
Thank you. And Joe Brewer from the Building Codes Division.
Chair, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm with Building Codes Division. I promise this issue is not nearly as complicated as low-voltage electricians.
Wonderful.
Very simply put, there's been a change in the nomenclature required by the National Board of Boiler Rules, the ASME. They've changed from heating surface, effective heating surface, to the terminology related to boiler horsepower. So this bill simply would allow our state to adopt that current nomenclature, defining boiler sizes by boiler horsepower instead of effective heating surface. If we were to stay with the old nomenclature, the old form of assessing fees, we would be then requiring property owners, plant owners, to go out and actually have a measurement conducted of the effective heating surface of their boiler. So that's what this bill is all about. It's a revenue neutral bill. We've crafted this in an attempt to avoid raising anyone's fees, and in fact, we have reduced the number of categories of boilers affected by this regulation from 6 to 5. So we've attempted to craft this in a way that it would impact no one, and in fact, make life easier for some folks. So our hope is that you would find it possible to support our bill. Happy to take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Brewer? Thank you, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tom Lindbergh.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Lindbergh. I work for Operating Engineers Local 701, and I'm the past chairman of the State Board of Boiler Rule. The current chairman is unable to be here. The board fully supports this change, and he asked me to drop by and reflect that.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Lindbergh?
Thank you, sir.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2245? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and we will open a work session on House Bill 2245.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. I move House Bill 2245 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2245 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions or discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Walker?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
Dahmer?
Aye.
Backlund?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Merkley?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
No. Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2245 is declared passed. Do I hear another motion?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
It's my understanding that Representative Hansen carries all the Board of Boiler Rules, but he doesn't serve on this committee. Can we still
sign it? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just want to move it.
Mr. Stenbush, is that...
Sure, you can ask any member to...
Oh, you just tell him.
The back.
And
you can have it.
Actually, I'll forgive you for that faux pas that you made earlier. Or that.
You can
I'm just feeling particularly mischievous.
Well, that'd get you off the hook with me. But just
We're going to request that Representative Hansen carry this bill.
Excellent.
If Representative Hansen refuses, Representative Walker will be carrying it.
Excellent.
And we will close the work session on House Bill 2245. We're headed back to open a work session on House Bill 2696.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Are we in a work session?
We are in work session.
Thank you. I move House Bill 2696 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2696 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions or discussion? Seeing and hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Wilson?
Aye.
Donner?
Aye.
Backlund?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Merkley?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Walker?
Aye.
No. Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2696 is declared passed. And in a show of bipartisan support, I'm going to have Representatives Kefauri and Patridge carry this bill together on the floor. Should they so choose to do so. If they do not, I'm going to have Representative Nelson carry the bill as a backup carrier.
Excellent.
And we will close the work session on House Bill 2696.
She's doing a masterful job as chair. This is a man.
I believe that ends our stated agenda.
I've seen few examples of it in this world. This is
we have 25 minutes left, so is there anyone who would like to sing a song?
He's going into the job, hasn't he?
No.
Representative Nelson wants to sing.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Serious.
You know I was
my microphone ready.
Oh, okay.
Speaking to the microphone.
Well, on this amendment for the electricians.
On 2152.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Is it appropriate to ask a question now?
You can ask a question before we leave. Sure.
Okay. When you put a work session together to bring entities together.
Well, it won't be a work session.
It's not a work session.
They are outside this committee, and Representative Zahner and Rosenbaum are going to oversee their little meeting that they may have to try to work this out. Should they not be able to work it out, we do have some amendments. I'm sure others will bring other amendments, and we will have the committee either go through them, or we'll just forget the bill altogether if they can't work it out. That's the pain I was talking about. They both want this bill off the bat.
So. Chair, I think she meant work group.
Did you mean work group or work session?
I don't know, because I've been on a committee that had one of these happen. That's what I'm trying to...
Yeah, it would be, instead of work session, it would be work group, and it would be informal.
So, excuse me, Mr. Chair, so we do not, in the thought that they might not come to agreement, in the meantime, we do not need to prepare an amendment.
You don't have to prepare an amendment unless you want to. You could. You could come up with all the amendments you wanted for the bill. I'm not encouraging that, but you could do that.
But most usually, you bet on their coming to one...
I think they're going to come to an agreement. That's my guess.
I've never seen this happen, so it's new to me.
Well, let's hope it does happen.
Okay, thank you. No, I mean, I've never seen it. It's new to me.
And we will close committee. Committee adjourned.